Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Talking on a telephone because of weather conditions where I'm at, and hopefully you'll be able to hear the program. Sorry that we're not on live with the microphone. Hopefully that'll be remedied shortly. Today we're going to be looking at just an hour of TV a day if you're young really affects your weight and how fish liver oil, remember cod liver oil was given to so many of us when we were growing up? Well, our mothers knew best. I'll tell you how that can help us live a longer life. Also, what is the ability of cannabis oil and the active cannabinoids to help you if you have cancer? And a lot of people claim that they have what is called a chemo brain. Now, this means people who've received chemotherapy can end up wandering with their brain. They don't have an ability to concentrate, and hence dubbed chemo brain. We'll tell you about that. Consuming less salt reduces stomach risk, cancer, and eating less can slow the aging process. Plus, today, we're going to take on with Dr. Elizabeth Warren the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty. In my opinion, it will mean literally the destruction of our Constitution, our Bill of Rights, our sovereignties, and our capacity to have a meaningful, sustainable life. We will be so corporatized that we will have no freedoms, and all the people engaged in this, from the President of the United States down, they are all fully aware of the consequences of this piece of legislation. And yet they've kept it in secret. Now Congress is about to enact the ability to fast-track, meaning no amendments. Ralph Nader, in a special commentary, then I will give a special commentary on Ralph Nader. Ralph Nader calls these the free traders, and good for him. Dr. Ellen Brown, the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Death of the Republic, A Web of Debt. Then we're going to hear from John Oliver taking on an interesting way that he does. And hopefully my editing team in New York has edited and out all of his cursing. So I'm giving a heads up to our archive. Please, that he's always laces it with profanity. We can't have that on the air. But what he has to say is interesting, and I'll address it, because some of the things he suggests are correct, and some of them are really off base. And then we will complete our program with part five of one of the most articulate, insightful, and reasoned positions on vaccine by Dr. Suzanne Humphreys, who has taken the time to know the subject better than any other doctor in America. So we have two more parts today and tomorrow. Also, for those of you who were in the Northern California area, on Saturday, I did a live three-hour debate. I was asked to defend the mothers and fathers who wanted a right of freedom of choice to object to mandatory vaccines. So it was nonstop, no commercials. It was the largest radio station in Northern California, and with a heavy audience in the Silicon Valley. So if you can download that, listen, because I heard during the top of the news when they went to a CBS news break that, and I don't know if they knew I was able to hear, they didn't block my feed, that it was the largest amount of people in the history of the entire radio station listening and calling in on a show. They didn't take any calls, though, because the debate was fierce. And I took no prisoners on this one. And you want to hear a tough debate? Listen to that nonstop 3 hours. I don't care who they threw at us. We made short order because all they had was propaganda, lies, distortions. They didn't have facts. And I believe the public is interested in what is the truth. Also, I showed where the people sponsoring the bill actually were in violation of the law. I cited the actual verse of the law and also some violation of the Supreme Court 14th Amendment, and I cited the Supreme Court case showing that the federal government does can only grant to the state the right to intercede on behalf of a child if it's shown and proven that that parent is negligent and their negligence represents a clear and present danger to the child. That means that with this law mandating no opportunity to opt out of vaccination, every parent in the state of California is now deemed unfit, and therefore the state is superseding the power of the parent. That already has been determined by the Supreme Court. So I ask the lawyers in the audience to sue the state of California and get it in the Supreme Court, where there's a great opportunity for this to be heard, and won, because it already was in 2000, and I gave the specific cases, et cetera. Anyhow, you got to hear the debate, and let us go on the record. I am willing to debate any person who represents the pro-vaccine position on this station, on my program, at any time. We are actively going after the debates because they're working the deals behind the scenes, and I showed how 27 lawmakers in California, I showed the exact amount of money they received, and how they, after they received that money, they immediately voted for this legislation, which, by the way, is against the laws of the that their own state has enacted. So hopefully this will cause a review, an ethics review of all those people that accepted money. And I knew the exact amount of money, and I gave the person's name and the amount of money, including the chief sponsor. In California, by the way, we have a lot of people listening. You're only allowed to receive $250 a year from any outside source. Beyond that, you cannot, on any level, for any reason, under any circumstance, lobby on behalf of someone who's giving that money. It's against the law. And yet they did it. So that's that. Now, let us go to the latest. I just counseled someone who had been on chemotherapy. And in fact, it was someone who was actually in the medical field in chemotherapy. That was their specialization for 40 years. And the person said that they have lost all cognition, and they didn't anticipate that. Well, according to the University of British Columbia, quote, research that chemotherapy can lead to excessive mind wandering and the inability to concentrate, dubbed chemo brain, the negative cognitive effects of the cancer treatment have long been suspected, but the University of British Columbia is the first to explain why patients have difficulty paying attention. And they went into how breast cancer survivors were involved in the in this, and they found that it impacts the brain and deranges the brain. Remember, chemotherapy causes cancer, and I have not seen the science supporting its efficacy or safety. In any case, if one more thing that you can add to hair falling out, nausea, sickness, secondary infection and death from chemotherapy is loss of cognition. Your mind wanders. You have a hard time focusing, hard time remembering what you just saw, read, listened to. We know that we consume too much salt. Okay, you can get high blood pressure. Well, we know that. And heart disease. And we know that. What we didn't know was that the more salt you eat, the more at risk you are of stomach cancer. This is brand new. And it's well established now that stomach cancer risk is infection with a bacterium, and I've just discussed this last week, Helicobacter pylori, or what's called H. pylori, which causes extreme inflammation within the stomach that can progress to stomach cancer, and it seems like salt stimulates that in a big way, less than 1 teaspoon per day. So we're not talking about a lot of salt. A lot of people have more than that on just French fries and one meal, and you get salt and everything. So get rid of the salt, unless it's Himalayan sea salt, even that use sparingly. Make sure that you're using potassium to balance it. Maybe 500 milligrams of potassium will help balance the sodium. And if you have cancer, get off salt altogether. You can get natural sodium, enough to supply the body with its needs for sodium, but you want potassium. And sodium at high levels feeds cancer. And potassium helps stop that. Around the world, cultures eat different amounts of food. some people eat three meals a day. Some people eat one large meal and then snack, graze throughout the day. That's what I recommend, one substantive meal. But then a smoothie in the morning with all your nutrients, and instead of eating it and chewing it, you're drinking it, but you're actually getting more nutrients because it's concentrated. There's only so many blueberries you can eat. But if you had 2 tablespoons of blueberry concentrate, that's equivalent to more than 2 pints of blueberries. And there's only so many apples you can eat. Let's say you could eat maybe 1 apple, 2 apples a day. But in one glass, 12-ounce glass, you can get 4 apples. So it's always best to concentrate in the morning because you're flooding the body, cleansing, detoxifying, purifying, and loading it up with phytonutrients. And then a light meal, and a very small meal in the early evening, and then just graze. You're hungry? Have a single item. And that's one way to live a longer life. Around the world, those individual cultures that have plenty of food but choose not to overeat live longer lives. The Chinese people are a good example of this, as are the Japanese people. It's only when they start westernizing their diet that they begin to come down with obesity and diabetes and heart disease. That's also true in India. The yogis are notorious for being lean and having low pulses and living long lives, and they eat very little. Well, we're the gluttons. We don't leave any food on the table or on the floor if it should fall off the table. We eat not just super-sized, that's so yesterday. We eat mega-size. We eat gigantic. When you walk into any restaurant that's very popular around the United States today, you're more likely to find a large meal. And all because of this idea that you should have 2, 3, or 4 pounds of food in a given meal. The body doesn't need it. It stresses it. It stresses your metabolism, your digestion, your elimination, and it creates metabolic overload. You literally are overflowing the glass of water. But people don't care. It's a conditioned response. And if you suggest otherwise, they give you that kind of flippant, self-righteous attitude, which may protect them in the argument, but really hurts them in the long run. This is the latest on this topic from the peer-reviewed journal Rejuvenation Research. And this is also reported in the Healthy News. Quote, cutting just 300 to 500 calories a day from your diet could be the key to slowing the signs of aging and living longer, according to a new study. Now, studies have long shown that reducing calorie intake slows the aging process, and a popular theory is that fewer daily calories decreases production of the thyroid hormone T3, which then slows metabolism and tissue aging. A new study at St. Louis University found this hormone decrease occurs when humans regularly skip rich desserts or substitute, let's say, a healthier meal for a Big Mac and fries every day. Quote, our research provides evidence that calorie restriction does work in humans like it has been shown to work in animals. This is a professor of nutrition dietetics at St. Louis University's College of Health Sciences. The next step is to determine if, in fact, slows age-related disease deterioration. Well, that person should be looking at the research. We've seen this in hundreds of studies. The best study on this is the Mediterranean diet. Interesting, if you look at the Mediterranean diet as it is historically and traditionally served, you'll find you don't have people giving you a big plate stuffed with food. It's courses. And the size of a course is generally a little bigger than a saucer. So you don't feel like you're getting a lot of food, because when you look at it, the first plate to the antipasto, or then the second one, the salad, or the third, the soup, or the fourth, the pasta, whatever it may be. And then your dessert, it's plenty of food, but it's lots of living food, raw, locally grown, rich in nutrients, and not high in calories. And they take their time eating it, hence they don't overwhelm the metabolism. It's very common to take an hour to an hour and a half to eat the main meal, and a very light meal in the evening in the European, Western European Mediterranean area. An avocado has more potassium than bananas. Now, we've been celebrating avocados for a long time because of its creamy texture and its great nutrition. It's really healthy. But what we didn't appreciate was how rich it was in potassium until this study. A ripe avocado is rich in vitamins, minerals, and phytonutrients, very good fats for your heart. And while it's considered a vegetable, it's actually a fruit. And it's rich in monounsaturated fats that help reduce the bad cholesterol, and that's important. And avocados contain lutein, a cancer-fighting carotenoid, and more than almost any other fruit. And men who eat foods rich in lutein have lower rates of prostate cancer, and lutein also protects your eyes from macular degeneration and cataracts. Another anti-cancer component of avocados is glutathione, a tripeptide composed of amino acids that acts like an antioxidant, and it's also rich in potassium. So you might want to be having a potassium-rich smoothie by taking avocado, and you can blend in protein with avocado, nut butter with avocado. That'll sustain you for about 5 hours, and is really healthy. And also one final thing here, and that is brain exercise can enhance memory and thinking in older adults. This is from Science Daily. And what it shows is that from the University of Southern California, the Andrus Gerontology Center, they found that when you, and this was a randomized double-blind controlled study of 524 healthy adults, when one group was looking at challenging their memory by brain exercises, they benefited. When the other did not, they did not. And you can not only gain better memory, you can keep your memory longer. But that means you're going to have to challenge it. Challenge it by listening to classical music, by listening to poems, by learning a language, by playing an instrument, crossword puzzles. That challenges, that's a brain exercise, and that enhances memory and thinking, and it can sustain it for a long time. One other thing, this is from the Journal of Thrombosis. If you exercise regularly, you have a substantial percentage, 39% women, of preventing a stroke, reducing the risk of blood clots. Researchers from Leiden University Medical Center in the Netherlands evaluated 7,860 people, 18 to 70, and they found that those who had blood clots exercised less, those who exercised more, had a substantial difference. So your aerobic, this is aerobic exercise I'm talking about, not resistance muscle exercise, you reduce your risk of a blood clot. So that's all important. And socializing may keep the elderly mind sharp. Those who mingle the most, those who have the most interactions, show the least cognitive decline. And that was from the Rush University Medical Center, who found, quote, elderly people with the highest levels of social activity, doing things like visiting friends, going to parties, attending church, showed much lower levels of cognitive decline than those who were loners or least socially active. I'm Gary Noll. That's the latest on health and nutrition. We're going to take a break. Please stay with us. Back in a moment.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of. Knowing I love you so. Goodbye, dear. loving you the way I do, I take you back. Without you, I die, dear. Knowing I love you so, anyone who had a heart would take me in his arms and love me too. You couldn't really have a heart and hurt me like you hurt me and be so true. What am I to do?
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. We hopefully have a good connection now. I just hung up the telephone. And in this segment, I'm going to be focusing on the Trans-Pacific Partnership and the Death of the Republic by Ellen Brown, Professor Ellen Brown. Quote, "The United States shall guarantee to every state in the Union a republic form of government, Article 4, Section 4 of the U.S. Constitution." Now, a republican form of government is one in which power resides in elected officials representing the citizens, and government leaders exercise power according to the rule of law. In the Federalist Papers, James Madison defined a republic as a government which derives all of its powers directly or indirectly from the great body of the people. On April 22, 2015, the Senate Finance Committee approved a bill to fast-track the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a massive trade agreement that would override our republican form of government and hand judicial and legislative authority to a foreign three-person panel of corporate lawyers. The secretive Trans-Pacific Partnership is an agreement with Mexico, Canada, Japan, Singapore, and seven other countries that affects 40% of global markets. Fast-tracked authority would now go to the full Senate for a vote as early as next week. Fast-track means Congress will be prohibited from amending the trade deal, which will be put to a single up-and-down majority vote. Negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership in secret and fast-tracking it through Congress is considered necessary to secure its passage, since if the public ever found out, the onerous provisions opposition would mount and defeat it. What we really are doing, however, is we're abdicating the judicial function to corporate lawyers. James Madison wrote in the Federalist Papers, "The accumulation of all powers, legislative, executive, and judiciary, in the same hands, may justly be pronounced the very definition of tyranny. Were the power of judging joined with the legislative, the life and liberty of the subject would be exposed to arbitrary control, for the judge would then be the legislator." And that, from what we now know of the Trans-Pacific Partnership secret provisions, will be its dire effect. The most controversial provision of the TPP is the investor-state dispute settlement section, which strengthens existing investor-state dispute procedures. So what you have, in effect, according to Professor Brown, is you have $700 and up hour all lawyers who have little incentive to dismiss cases, and the secret nature of the arbitration process, which is not, you cannot go in for an appeal. Their verdict is final, and they work for the very corporations that stand to gain or lose. And we have already seen how bad this can be because of what happened with NAFTA. So that's her concern. Now, we're going to play a segment from one of our legislators, Elizabeth Warren, who also takes issue with the secrecy in arbitration behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's hear what she has to say.
Mr. President, the United States is in the final stages of negotiating the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a massive free trade agreement with Mexico, Canada, Japan, Singapore, and seven other countries. And I come to the floor today to ask a fundamental question. Who will benefit from the TPP? American workers, consumers, small businesses, taxpayers, or the biggest multinational corporations in the world? One strong hit is buried down in the fine print of the closely guarded draft. The provision, an increasingly common feature of international trade agreements, is called Investor Dispute Settlement, or ISDS. Now, the name may sound mild, but this provision fundamentally tilts the playing field further in favor of big multinational corporations. Worse yet, it undermines U.S. sovereignty. ISDS allows foreign companies to challenge American laws and potentially pick up huge payouts from taxpayers without ever stepping foot in an American court. Now, here's how it works. Imagine that the United States bans a toxic chemical that is often added to gasoline. We ban it because we believe it is dangerous for people's health or harmful to the environment. If a foreign company that makes this toxic chemical wants to sell it in the U.S., it would normally have to challenge that in a U.S. court. But with ISDS, the company could skip the U.S. court and go before an international panel of arbitrators. If the company wins, the ruling cannot be challenged in U.S. courts, and the arbitration panel could require the American taxpayers to cough up millions, even billions of dollars in damages. ISDS has the power to impose gigantic fines, but it doesn't have independent judges. Instead, highly paid corporate lawyers go back and forth between representing corporations one day and sitting in judgment of corporations the next. Now, I don't know, maybe that makes sense in an arbitration between two corporations, but not in cases between corporations and governments. We should have real doubts about how likely it is that a lawyer looking to attract high-paying corporate clients will rule against those corporations when it's his or her turn to sit in the judge's seat. It's also a real problem that only international investors, get to use these courts. Investors that are, by and large corporations. If a Vietnamese company with American operations wants to challenge an increase in the U.S. minimum wage, it can use ISDS. But if an American labor union believes the Vietnamese companies are paying slave labor wages in violation of trade commitments, the union has to try to wind itself through the Vietnamese courts. Good luck with that. These rigged pseudo-courts were created after World War II because investors worried about putting money into developing countries where the legal systems were just not as dependable. They were concerned that a corporation might build a plant today only to watch a dictator confiscate it tomorrow. ISDS was born to encourage foreign investment in countries with weak legal systems. Now, look, I don't know if these justifications made sense back then, but they sure don't make sense now. Countries in the TPP are hardly emerging economies with weak legal systems. Australia and Japan have well-developed, well-respected legal systems, and multinational corporations navigate those legal systems every single day. But ISDS would preempt their courts, too. And to the extent there are countries that are riskier politically, market competition can solve that problem. Countries that respect property rights and the rule of law, like the United States, should be more competitive. And if a company wants to invest in a country with a weak legal system, then it should buy political risk insurance, which is available. The use of ISDS is on the rise. From 1959 to 2002, there were fewer than 100 ISDS claims worldwide. But by 2012 alone, there were 58 cases. That's in 1 year. Here are some examples of recent cases under various treaties with ISDS provisions. A French company sued Egypt because Egypt raised its minimum wage. A Swedish company sued Germany because Germany decided to phase out nuclear power after the Fukushima disaster. A Dutch company sued the Czech Republic because the Czech Republic didn't bail out a bank that the Dutch company partially owned. And American corporations are getting in on the action, too. Philip Morris is trying to use ISDS to stop Uruguay from implementing new tobacco regulations aimed at cutting domestic smoking rates. Now, ISDS advocates point out that, hey, so far this process hasn't hurt the United States. And our negotiators, who refuse to make the text of this trade agreement public, claim that it will include a bigger, better version of ISDS that will protect our ability to regulate in the public interest. But with ISDS cases exploding in the last several years and more multinational corporations headquartered abroad, it is only a matter of time before such a challenge does serious damage here. Letting a panel of arbitrators replace the U.S. legal system with a complex and unnecessary alternative on the assumption that nothing could possibly go wrong seems like a really bad idea. This isn't a partisan issue. Now, I don't often agree with the conservative Cato Institute, and I suspect they don't often agree with me. But this morning, the head of Cato's trade policy program said that ISDS, and I quote, raises serious questions about democratic accountability, sovereignty, checks and balances, and the separation of power. And he went on to say, these concerns about ISDS are, quote, ones that libertarians and other free market advocates should share. I think that's right. Conservatives who believe in American sovereignty are outraged that ISDS shifts power from American courts, as envisioned by our Constitution, to unaccountable international tribunals. Libertarians are offended that ISDS effectively offers a free taxpayer subsidy to countries with weaker legal systems. And progressives should oppose ISDS because it allows big multinationals to weaken labor and environmental rules. Giving foreign corporations special rights to challenge our laws outside of our legal system is a bad deal. So long as TPP includes investor-state dispute settlement, the only winners will be international corporations.
And that was Elizabeth Warren. This is from Ralph Nader from Common Dreams. We have posted it for you to download, Obama Corporate Free Traders and You. President Obama is standing with U.S. Trade Representative Michael Froman outside the White House in June of 2013. Froman was nominated by the president for the top position and is now among the key targets of protests and critics who decry the administration's trade policy. The big pro-business president, Barack Obama, and his corporate allies are starting their campaign to manipulate and pressure Congress to ram through the Pull Down on America Trans-Pacific Partnership, a trade and foreign investment treaty between 12 nations. The first skirmish is a fast-track bill to have Congress formally strip itself of its constitutional authority to regulate trade and surrender its historic responsibility to the White House and its corporate lobbies. Lest you think the Trans-Pacific Partnership is too commercially complex to bother about, think again. This mega-treaty is the latest corporate coup d'etat that sacrifices the American consumer, labor, and environmental standards, inventively called non-tariff trade barriers, and much U.S. sovereignty to the supremacy of corporate commercial trade. No single column can be adequately describe this colossal betrayal. Camouflaged by phrases like free trade and win-win agreements, for comprehensive analysis, you can go to Global Trade Watch. Trade treaties like NAFTA and GATT, which created the World Trade Organization, already have proven records of harming our country through huge job exporting trade deficits, unemployment, freezing or jeopardizing our consumer and environmental rules, holding down regulations on giant banks, and weakening labor protections. How does the corporate state and its free traders construct a transnational form of autocratic governance that bypasses the powers of our branches of government and accepts decisions that greatly affect American livelihoods, issued by secret tribunals run by corporate lawyers turned judges? Well, first they establish autocratic procedures such as fast-track legislation that facilitate the creation of an absentee autocratic government, which betrays the American people by going far beyond reducing tariffs and quotas. Imagine when the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty finally gets negotiated with other nations in secret. The White House cynically classifies it as an agreement requiring a simple majority vote, not a treaty requiring two-thirds of Congress for passage. Fast-track legislation then limits debate on the Trans-Pacific Partnership to a total of 20 hours in each chamber. then Congress lets the White House tie Congress's hands by prohibiting any amendments and requesting just an up or down vote. Meanwhile, the campaign cash flows into the abdicating lawmakers' bank accounts from the likes of Boeing, General Electric, Pfizer, Citigroup, ExxonMobil, and other multinational corporations that show a lack of loyalty to the United States. Due to their ties to communist and fascist regimes abroad, who let them get away with horrible abuses and repression in the name of greater profits. Many of these Pacific Rim countries, for example, have bad labor laws and practices, few, if any, consumer or environmental protections that can be enforced in courts of law, and precious little freedom of speech. A recent treaty with South Korea was pushed through Congress on false predictions of jobs and win-win solutions. In fact, Korea government showed a ballooning trade deficit that the United States has, and Americans lost 60,000 jobs. The majority of these corporate-managed trade agreements come from demands of global corporations. They exploit developing countries that have cheap labor and lax laws. Unlike more developed countries, such as the United States, they have greater protections for consumers, workers, and the environment. Under this trade agreement, countries that seek better protections for their workers and consumers can be sued by corporations and other nations. Remarkably, better treatment, such as safer motor vehicles, is seen as an obstructive trade barrier against inferior imports. For one example of many, under the World Trade Organization, the U.S. cannot keep our products made by brutal child labor abroad, even though U.S. Law prohibits child labor in this country. How absurd is this? This is sovereignty being shredded. So if we see a country that is using child labor, in effect slave labor, to make a shirt, we cannot bar that shirt from being sold in the United States. Congressman Lloyd Doggett, Democrat from Texas, former Texas Supreme Court Justice, told Politico, quote, "I do not believe that Congress should relinquish its trade oversight authority. This is really a fast track seeking to railroad the Trans-Pacific Partnership through while the United States Trade Representative hides from Congress the most important details." So, that is Ralph Nader. Now, I have a comment about Ralph Nader, and I'm going to put this into the larger context. This is for those individuals who have been extremely rewarded for being a pro-corporate Democrat. What is known as blue, these are these are corporatist Democrats or corporate liberals. And there are a lot of them. And they control much of the media. They control a lot of corporations, universities, and publishing companies. So they have a lot of say-so. The Clintons, in their first go-about, left behind about 1,600 of these technocrats and plutocrats in positions of power. Every administration leaves behind people to protect their legacy and to keep them informed. But these people then become a permanent governing force. So when it comes time for, let's say, an election cycle, do we see real progressives or populists or people who would radically adjust the political agenda? No, never. We might see, you know, arch-conservative like Ross Perot, but even he had it right when it came to the World Trade Organization. We would lose a lot of jobs, and we did. You don't see Ralph Nader, for example, very often in the media, and when you do, he's frequently mocked. He has been attacked more by the left than by the right, and The Nation magazine has saw fit, as well as other leading liberal organizations, not to support the multiple candidates who are truly populist. Okay, fair enough. But let's say that Ralph Nader had been elected because he would have been given an opportunity to be in all the debates and people would have understood what he was really saying. Here's what the world would be like today. So listen up. This is important. There would be no Glass-Steagall Act repeal or any other bill that would have allowed speculative trading and derivatives being tied with traditional savings and loans, that would have been still in place. We'd had a Glass-Steagall. It was Clinton working with his group of economic advisors and his Treasury Secretary, Robert Rubin, that caused the evisceration of Glass-Steagall. He would have banned trading in commodities that are necessary for life. He would have banned trading in food, land, and water. You could not have commodified them. There would be no NAFTA, CAFTA, or GATT, no World Trade Organization, and hence there would be no Trans-Pacific Partnership. There would not have been $23 trillion given through the bailouts over a period of 5 years to Wall Street houses, as there has been. You would not see all of those executives within the business community in Wall Street walking free to enjoy their ill-gotten gains. They would be in jail. Not one has gone to jail. Just today, we're hearing about a $2.5 billion settlement in the case of a major bank, one of the largest banks in the world, but no one was held accountable. No one went to jail. No reputations were sullied. And yet they manipulated the LIBOR fraud for hundreds of billions of dollars. They get to keep all of their ill-gotten gains. There'd be no Citizens United. All political parties would start equally at the starting gate because he would have advocated for taking money out of politics. He would have stopped the Federal Reserve from giving any more get-out-of-jail-free money to the banks. He would have declared a moratorium on home foreclosures. He would have created a national food program to see that the 16 million hungry children today in the United States are fed. He would have de-ghettoized America's program of food distribution, bypassing corporations and working directly with communities. He would have strengthened America's conservation to protect wildlife and natural landscapes and forests. We would not have, for example, all the animals being killed by an Interior Department that kills over 2 million animals each year, including bears and foxes and wolves, with impunity. He would have launched a domestic Marshall Plan to rebuild U.S. infrastructure and provide jobs. He would have forgiven all student late fees and cap all interest rates at student loans at 1%. He would have repealed the laws to prevent student loan holders from declaring bankruptcy. He would have passed laws that would have improved the quality of life of senior citizens and the elderly. He would have strengthened small business opportunities and increased the minimum wage. He would have closed and decommissioned all nuclear plants and shifted investment to support geothermal, solar, wind, and energy. He would have banned all private funding of elections. He would have taken corporate money out of politics. He would have demilitarized our forces around the world and closed military bases. He would never have militarized local law enforcement. All of the people that you see today, virtually every day, innocent people who've been charged with no crime, being killed, who are armless, well, that would have stopped because he would have told his Justice Department, Attorney General, to go after these local police departments and the police. So no one's doing that now. He would have audited the Federal Reserve, the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, and I don't believe that we had had any more than just one agency, and that one would have been curtailed, the CIA. He would have reduced their budgets. He would have, and the lobbying would be regulated. There would be no such government ruling as GMOs as substantially equivalent to their natural counterpart. Therefore, Monsanto would not be a separate branch of our government. The privatization of city infrastructures and city politics, such as Detroit, would be banned. He would have advocated universal health care. And since U.S. would already be on the way to becoming energy independent and with renewable energies, there'd be no need for massive hydrofracking, chemicals, and fracking fluids. They would not be allowed. There'd be no private industrial prison complex that has done nothing but scavenge off taxpayers to fund at cost far exceeding if prisons were run publicly. And he would have gotten rid of the death penalty. Nixon's war on drugs that continues today, which has caused over a million people to be killed and many millions to be in prison, would have been rescinded. No debtors' prisons would be allowed in the United States, and the SWAT teams that carried out 80,000 raids last year, most of them for people failing with their debt payments, would not happen. Private center groups would be banned from union busting. Non-profiteering from Iraq and Afghanistan would have been not exist because they wouldn't have been invaded. As a result, there'd be no ISIS today. There'd be no humanitarian crisis in other nations due to U.S. covert operations to trigger regime change, Honduras, Paraguay, Ukraine, and now Venezuela. And not having propped up a fascist neo-Nazi government in Ukraine, there would be no explosive tensions between the United States and Russia, and I doubt that we would still have NATO today. Now, those are just some of the things you should consider. Had the people on the left, Bill Maher, Michael Moore, and others, had a bigger picture, bigger view. They certainly have a right to their opinion, but just think of the consequence if this one man who caused more laws to protect us to be passed than any other person or legislator in American history. But they simply felt they had all the answers, they were right, they had an agenda, and what do we have to show for the world we're in today because of these people and their institutions? I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. If you've just joined us, a lot of people listen over the telephone because they travel, they're all over the place, they can't get to a land-based station or to the internet. So here's the number to call if you need to listen to the show at noon Eastern Standard Time. Call 712-432-7231, 712-432-7231. Now, we're going to play part of what John Oliver, Time doesn't allow us to play all of it, but you'll get the message, and I'll give you a few closing thoughts. Please listen.
I would like to talk about doctors. They're among our most trusted professionals. Nearly 70% of us rate them highly on ethical standards. Our lives and occasionally our balls are in their hands. Which is why it was especially troubling last week to see this.
With his syndicated TV show, magazine, and website, Dr. Oz has become one of America's most trusted docs. But on Capitol Hill Tuesday, he was on the hot seat.
Excuse me, but any seat Dr. Oz is sitting on is the hot seat. So, what did the doctor do?
They criticized the talk show host for describing untested weight loss supplements as magical or miraculous.
I want you to write it down. Garcinia Cambogia, because it may be the simple solution you've been looking for to bust your body fat for good.
Now I've got the number one miracle in a bottle to burn your fat.
Lightning in a bottle. It's a miracle flower to fight fat.
Miracle flowers? Are you a doctor or an Old West traveling salesman? Have I got something miraculous for you, ladies and gentlemen? A monkey's paw mixed with five petals of a rose and a thimble full of otter semen. Guaranteed to cure your lumbago. Step right up here. The Senate hearing was about the marketing of dietary supplements, and unfortunately, no one is more effective at that than Dr. Oz.
Oz's advice is so influential that one mention of a product can cause sales to skyrocket. The phenomenon even has its own name, the Dr. Oz effect. After Dr. Oz touted a substance called green coffee bean extract, one company in Florida sold 500,000 bottles.
Well, what's so wrong with that? Name me one case where a man named Oz claimed mystical powers and led people horribly astray. Name me one case. You can't do it. The only problem with the Dr. Oz effect is that magic pills don't technically exist, and Dr. Oz knows that.
Do you believe that there's a miracle pill out there?
There's not a pill that's going to help you long-term lose weight and live the best life without diet and exercise.
Do you believe there's a magic weight loss cure out there?
The word, if you're selling something because it's magical, no.
Right. That would be ridiculous. No one is claiming there's a magic pill out there. That would be stupid.
This little bean has scientists saying they found the magic weight loss cure for every body type.
See? He never said there was a magic pill. He said there was a magic bean. That clearly entirely different, because magic beans are a very real thing that you trade your cow for so you can steal a golden harp from a giant. That's science. And by the way, a recent study found the main ingredient in those magic beans not only failed to help lab mice, it gave them the early symptoms of diabetes. Though, if you're a lab mouse with diabetes, you got off easy. Good luck getting any sympathy in the lab mouse support group. Oh, I'm sorry, you can't have any candy. I've got an ear growing out of my f***ing back. Jeff's got herpes. Sorry, Jeff. Here's the issue. Dr. Oz is a doctor, and one with degrees from two Ivy League schools. He's also dangerously likable. Watch how Morning Joe reacted after seeing bits of his congressional testimony.
I only bought them once. It didn't.
Can I just say?
Did you buy them because you saw them on Dr. Oz?
I like Dr. Oz. I will confirm or deny.
I like him a lot.
I like him a lot.
I love Dr. Oz.
And he's come here with really good advice.
He has great advice. And listen, if he's got magic coffee beans, I want some of that.
Me too.
No, seriously.
You just showed a report that implied they didn't work. You basically just did an Emperor's New Clothes piece and then ended it by saying, by the way, the Emperor's tailor was incredible. That guy can stitch. And to give Dr. Ross the benefit
Here's my perspective on this. Back in the 1990s, I was the first person to introduce Dr. Ross to a national audience on PBS. He was on my program, Get Healthy Now, on PBS, which was everywhere. And of the 12 people who were in the panel that day, my hope was that all of these people would be able to contribute to the scientific basis of complementary medicine, meaning take a little bit of time and a little bit of resources and show that what you're doing has a good basis grounded in good independent science, because the science is there. Several of the people did. Dr. Martin Feldman did. He had tens of thousands of studies that he could use to show that anything that alternative medicine was using at the time, like chelation therapy, actually worked compared to those who said, oh, it doesn't work. For those of us who go out of our way to find the good science, I then started to see that this was not the case with Oz. He is certainly popular, but he's popular in a way that does not require the in-depth science. In fact, when we sent him over 50 documentaries on important social issues, not once responded, nor had any of the people from the documentaries on to talk about the issues, serious issues, not selling a product. In effect, he became the male version of Oprah. Not one of my favorite people. When you have to have your own face on every cover of your own magazine every week, that's narcissism. And also, it's all about maintaining fame, celebrity status, power, and the riches that come with that. But what if you use that fame and that power to educate the people, even when it meant going up against the special interest groups? And unfortunately, these people who have all this money and power, they don't do that because they know where the advertisers are. In the case right now, Dr. Oz is being attacked and challenged because of his position on genetic engineering. But that's because his wife is a very much pro-labeling GMO advocate. When I sent him over a bunch of material, would he do a program, a debate with the pro-vaccine and the challenging pro-vaccine groups? No response. But he made sure that he let his audience know he was pro-vaccine, but not for his kids, because, quote, when I'm at home, I'm not Dr. Oz, you know, I'm the husband. Okay, but think of all the people out there who will line up and have their children vaccinated because you're pro-vaccine. Instead of looking in the research, doing your homework, as Dr. Suzanne Humphreys and others have done. So when we marched against Monsanto, you weren't there. When we challenged mandatory vaccines, you weren't there. When we looked at our freedom of choice concerning our rights to choose, you weren't there. When it came to helping the homeless veterans and those with Gulf War syndrome, you weren't there. When it came to challenging nuclear power and closing down Shoreham, you weren't there. In fact, Dr. Oz, you haven't been there for any of the important things that really matter. And using that formidable audience and your substantial personality to help a cause that could certainly use it. Now you're being attacked, and the people attacking you all have conflicts of interest. Pull back and look at what you could have done in all these years since you appeared on that PBS show, and to have made it a healthier world in a meaningful way, not a commercial way, because there are no magic pills or potions. And adding in, oh, with some diet and exercise, doesn't cut it. I'm Gary Noll. Thank you all for listening. Look forward to sharing more on the next program. Have a nice day.
Anyone who ever loved could look at me and know that I love you. Anyone who ever dreamed could look at me and know I dream of you. Knowing I love you so much.